talking about a fascinating book now, and if you like your Sherlock Holmes, and I do, and Sir Arthur Conan Doyle in particular, you're going to like this book. It's called The Odlament Mystery, the real-life story behind the creation of Sherlock Holmes, and it's by Daniel Smith, and Daniel is joining us this afternoon. Good afternoon, Daniel. How are you?
Yeah, very well, thank you.
Great to have you on, because this is something that I didn't know much about, and it's quite a complex story. Just tell us, I hope I'm saying it right, is it the Odlamont mystery, is that right?
That's right, yeah.
And this is a murder that takes place, and it's got a link. And maybe before we get on to the actual murder itself, which is quite complex and fascinating, just tell us the link between that case and Arthur Conan Doyle.
Yeah, well, basically there was the death of a young man, which we can maybe talk about more in a moment.
Yeah.
And a very high-profile trial that followed in Edinburgh. And it really did captivate the whole of Victorian society. And two of the star witnesses for the Crown prosecution were a man called Joseph Bell and a colleague of his from Edinburgh University called Henry Littlejohn. And Bell had been a tutor of Conan Doyle's when Conan Doyle was studying medicine at the university. And Conan Doyle had, by that stage, in fact, just before the trial, had revealed in public that Bell had been an inspiration for the character of Sherlock Holmes. So that link was reasonably well established.
Yeah.
But Littlejohn didn't tend to get much of a mention in the story, but actually Bell and Littlejohn had been working on high-profile cases, very much under the radar, but they'd been called in on most of Scotland's big murder trials, murder cases for 20 years or so by then. And Littlejohn was an amazing forensics pioneer in his own right, and would undoubtedly have been in contact with Conan Doyle as well when he was a student. So it struck me rather strange that he had never been kind of brought into the story in the same way that Bell had. But then with this trial, you had them both there in a very high-profile case, and it just seemed a really great prism through which to look at just how they did influence Conan Doyle and the creation of Holmes.
And yet they were a partnership, and that, of course, is very much part of Sherlock Holmes' story as well. Was there anything taken from that perspective?
Yeah, I mean, interestingly, Bell, around the time of this trial, both men were very private, really, about their work with the police. But Bell gave a very rare interview, and in that interview, he sort of talked about how Littlejohn, who was officially the police surgeon at the time, so in an official capacity, he was responsible not only for the welfare of all the employees of the police service at the time, but he was also brought in to be the first man on the scene where there were suspicious deaths. He was involved in autopsies. And so Bell, in this interview, sort of spoke about how Littlejohn was the main man for the police, but he liked to have a number two who would accompany him on his investigations, and that he really took that role. So almost in Bell's own estimation, he was the Watson to Littlejohn's Holmes.
Yeah, and we've got to remember, of course, that at this particular moment in our history, this was quite new, all this medical analysis, and CSIs didn't exist, of course, did they?
No, and Edinburgh was right there in the middle of the development of it, and these two characters, and particularly Littlejohn, really were pivotal to all sorts of forensic discoveries. I mean, Littlejohn was an early adopter of fingerprinting techniques. He was one of the first British figures to recommend crime scene photography, which was obviously photography itself was in its infancy then, but nobody was using it within the police, but he was a very strong advocate of that. So wherever there were innovations, he was right there promoting them. He was also a very able medical man in his own right, and developed all sorts of autopsy techniques to get a better idea of, you know, how people actually died.
And do we know how much what Bell was like personally? Because, of course, we get to know a lot about Sherlock Holmes, and probably more, maybe there's a lot of embellishment. You know, Bell's maybe the starting point maybe for him. But was he a bit of an odd character like Sherlock as well, or not?
I'd say he was a much more humane character. He was a real... He was born into a long medical family with a long medical heritage, and he was almost predestined that he would go into the profession. But he was a very caring man. He was pivotal to the setting up of the Children's Hospital in Edinburgh. He did a lot of community work. He was actually a very strong advocate for better treatment of nurses, and nurses in those days were often treated as a little more than skivvies. But he strongly promoted better training for nurses, and also better treatment of women in general in the medical profession. He was a close friend of Florence Nightingale. He dedicated one of his books to her. So I think he's more humane in the round than Sherlock Holmes was. But the key skill that he had, which really transferred into the character of Holmes, was his ability to make diagnoses of people, of patients, without having any prior knowledge of them. So in his private practice, but also in the lecture theatres, his party piece really was to be presented with a patient who would say nothing to him, and he would give a sort of life story background of the patient, and then start making the medical diagnosis as well. And he sort of had this fairly unerring ability to be correct, and that was one of the key aspects that Conan Doyle was pretty knocked out by at the time, in which he talked about taking Bell's skill, doing that, and taking it to the extreme in the character of Holmes. So that's where the big crossover is.
Yeah, and you focus on one particular case, and it's quite a complex case in many ways, and really, where to begin with this? We're talking a killing of a young army lieutenant.
Yes, so this all happened in the same year that Conan Doyle was killing off Sherlock Holmes, so it's sort of this strange alchemy where it was all happening at the same time. But yes, in the summer of 1893, there was this young army man, Cecil Hambrough. He was 20 then, but since his late teens, he had been under the tutorship of a man called Alfred Monson. Hambrough came from a well-to-do family on the Isle of Wight, but who were down on their uppers, really. And Monson also came from a well-to-do family with genuine aristocratic connections, but he was really the black sheep of the family. And he had got involved in all sorts of nefarious goings-on in the years before Hambrough came under his tutorage. But anyway, Hambrough's father had owned a very big property on the Isle of Wight, which he had mortgaged, and he defaulted on the repayments, and so the property had been taken over by the mortgage company. So there was this potential to somehow win back the property for the family, and Monson had these ambitions that he might do that and make some money for himself in the process. So this was all going on in the background in 1893. Anyway, they were all living at this at the Ardlamont estate, Ardlamont from the title, in Scotland, and it was in August 10th, 1893. Hambrough, Monson, and a mysterious third man who was known as Mr. Scott went out on a hunting expedition early one morning, and Hambrough did not return. He was shot in the head in mysterious circumstances. And the local doctor was called in and designated it as an accidental death initially.
That he shot himself by mistake,
A couple of days later, it emerged that Monson's wife had life insurance policies out on Hambrough that Monson had taken in his wife's name. And this obviously aroused suspicion. The doctor reevaluated his initial conclusions, and a murder investigation ensued, and led to this sensational trial at the end of the year, at which Bell and Little John played prominent roles.
And there's twists and turns all the way. I mean, we don't want to give too much away, of course, because we want folks to listen to buy the book. But there's twists and turns in this story, isn't there? It's not a closed case, you know, straightforward one, is it?
It's an absolute gift for a writer like me. Whenever I have an idea for a book, the first thing I tend to do is then I'll go onto Amazon and see if anybody's already written all about it. And as I delved more and more into this story, it's almost a story that writes itself. Like you say, there are so many twists and turns. Plotting this was not a problem. It's just a fantastic story, which I hope I've managed to be able to tell in a readable way. But yeah, it's extraordinary twists and turns, not only in the investigation and during the trial, but in the years afterwards as well. And still today, we're left with all sorts of questions about what actually happened and who knew what, really.
I mean, it's a kind of classic Sherlock Holmes story in many ways. It's, you know, you've got the murderer up against the detective, and you know, you just couldn't make it. I mean, if you didn't know it was true, you'd think it was an Arthur Conan Doyle story, wouldn't you?
You would, and there were journalists at the time who were writing before they even knew that Little John and Bell were involved in the case. They were writing articles saying this is just the sort of murder where, or the sort of crime where we need Sherlock Holmes to be coming in and solving it for us. And, you know, journalists talking about how, unfortunately, real life is always messier than fiction. So all of those connections were already being made there, that this was really like something that Conan Doyle would have been conjuring up from his imagination.
So one of the lines that in the synopsis of the book says, "Will," and I can do this in the voice, "Will Bell and Little John's shared faith in science and reason be enough to see justice win out?" You'll have to buy the book to find out what the outcome is, I suppose. But it's a fascinating story, it really is. And just when you think you've got a grip on it, you think, oh, well, there's a motive. That's the motive, it's that. And then you think, oh, hang on a minute, it isn't. It's something else completely. It's not black and white at all.
It's not, no.
Again, I mean, it's, like you say, it kind of comes together at the same time as Arthur Conan Doyle's killing off Sherlock Holmes, which was a big shock, of course, wasn't it, to the fans?
Yeah.
So it was quite a year.
It was indeed, yeah. It was, you know, when Sherlock Holmes was killed off, there were the sort of crowds of people in London who were outside the offices of The Strand, which published all the Sherlock Holmes stories, and they were wearing black armbands as a symbol of their mourning at the passing of the great detective. But then at the same time in Edinburgh, you had literally hundreds and thousands of the public queuing around the block to witness the trial. And there's talk that people would queue for days on end just to walk past the door where the trial was being held, which had a window in it just so they could see the people who were involved in it. They didn't get to hear any of what was going on, but that was enough for some people. It was that sort of level of excitement. So that it all coincided at the same time was quite intriguing in its own right.
Without the spoilers, of course, Joseph Bell, Henry Littlejohn, what happens to them, you know, and their careers as they go through from here?
Well, they were both fairly senior figures already by this point, and as far as we know, like I say, they were quite private about their work with the police, but as far as we know, this was really the last great trial that they worked together on. But in the preceding 20 years, there have been all sorts of extraordinary ones. Bell, it's very frustrating for somebody like me, but Bell intimated in another interview that he gave several years later that he and Little John had been called in by Scotland Yard to investigate the Jack the Ripper murders, and that they had independently reviewed all of the evidence there, and then taken themselves off and each written the name of who they believed to be the chief suspect in an envelope. They opened the envelopes together, found out that they had both reached the same conclusion, and according to Bell, shortly afterwards, after they passed on their findings to Scotland Yard, the murders ended. So you kind of have these really intriguing kind of tastes of what they were up to. Unfortunately, that those letters and those envelopes don't exist anymore.
Oh, what a shame.
I know. I say they don't exist anymore, perhaps somewhere.
There's a twist in that story still to come. I should imagine there's no end of material in there, maybe another book in there, Daniel. What do you reckon?
I'd love to do another book on these two. I think they're fascinating.
Well, I can certainly see you're passionate for it. And the book's called The Ardlament Mystery, The Real Life Story Behind the Creation of Sherlock Holmes. It's available on our website. If you click on tre.radio, click on our bookshop banner, you'll be able to order the book that way. Daniel, thank you for coming. I really appreciate your time this afternoon.
Thank you very much for having me.
Lovely, good stuff. And I'm in the mood now to go and watch some Sherlock Holmes, but I'll have to wait. Thank you, Daniel. Take care.
Thanks. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.